problem of knowledge. Perhaps it is precisely the task of a philosophical investigation, ultimately to deprive many problems of their sham existence, to reduce the number of problems, and promote investigation which opens the way to the matters themselves. So I want to talk about what has come to be known as hinge epistemology, in a kind of reverse of Mark Antony, who came not to praise Caesar but to bury him. I come not to praise epistemology, hinge epistemology, but to bury it. So here are the passages from Wittgenstein's Notes on Certainty, 341 through 343. The questions we raise and our doubts depend on the fact that some propositions are exempt from doubt, are, as it were, like hinges on which those turn. That is to say, it belongs to the logic of our scientific investigations that certain propositions are indeed not doubted. But it isn't that the situation is like this, we just can't investigate everything, and for that reason we are forced to rest content with assumption. If I want the door to turn, the hinges must stay put. So hinge epistemology takes this metaphor of Wittgenstein's very seriously, that certain propositions are hinges of inquiry and of indeed doubting and justifying. And hinge epistemology, as I understand it, I once called it before the hinge epistemology title caught on, the framework reading, has two generic features. There are many distinct articulations of it, but this is the common basis. So commitment one, knowledge and justification depend on framework certainties, the riverbed of inquiry, hinges, which have a sui generis epistemic character, distinct from being known or even epistemically justified. And then two, recognizing this distinctive character or the role of hinge propositions is the key to undermining familiar forms of radical skepticism. Agrippan, or sometimes, as I call it, some more commonly called regress skepticism, and Cartesian, or external world skepticism, or Humean inductive skepticism. As I said, there are many versions of this. I think maybe Crispin Wright perhaps deserves a lot of credit for getting it off the ground. But there are versions recently in Duncan Pritchard, in Danielle Moyle Sharrock, in Annalisa Kaliva, Strawson going back, Marie McGinn, lots of people. Hinge epistemology. I want to make two claims. I want to claim that it fails both as a response to skepticism and relatedly as an account of Wittgenstein's views concerning knowledge and certainty. That's my first claim. My second claim is that even if Wittgenstein's views of knowledge are not fully settled, and after all, that's a possibility we can never wholly discount because uncertainty is a collection of notes written toward the end of his life, and in fact contain expressions of uncertainty as to whether he has really settled the questions. He nevertheless has a definite and perhaps predominant inclination to treat hinge commitments, or as I sometimes call them, bedrock certainties, as propositions that we know to be true. So I think because hinge epistemology ignores this, or by virtue of ignoring this, it reflects a much more general misunderstanding of Wittgenstein's aims and methods, and perhaps we'll get to that, perhaps we won't. Well, here's what Duncan Pritchard, I think, quite rightly calls a core problem for hinge epistemology. And here I'm quoting Pritchard. If hinges are, quote, neither knowable nor even justifiable, aren't they just irrational commitments? But if so, how does Wittgenstein's answer to skepticism, scare quotes, differ from skepticism itself? And I think it's quite clear that the various detailed accounts, competing accounts, of the sui generis character of Hinge propositions are best seen as responses to this problem. And some of the accounts, of course, are quite radical. Danielle Moyle-Sharrock answers that Hinge propositions, pace Wittgenstein, aren't even propositions. Duncan Pritchard has recently argued that, well, they may be propositions, but they aren't beliefs, or they aren't beliefs in the knowledge apt sense. These, I think, are extremely implausible things to say, and I think one should just recognize that. I put it like this. I think that these things that people say, Hinge epistemologists say, have no independent plausibility. That's to say, it will seem to you, if you're antecedently convinced that Hinge epistemology is on the right track, that you're going to have to say something about what Pritchard correctly identifies as a core problem for what you've said. In other words, but otherwise, they have very little grounding, if any, in evident features of ordinary epistemic practice. In other words, they have all the earmarks of epicycles, ad hoc hypotheses introduced to defend a theoretical view that seems on its face inadequate. Well, with that in mind, let's go back to the Hinge passages themselves, and let me reread passage 341. As it's usually quoted, the questions we raise and our doubts depend on the fact that some propositions are exempt from doubt, are, as it were, like hinges on which those turn. The first thing to note is the ellipsis, dot, dot, dot. So a phrase has been missed out. And what is that phrase? That phrase is, that is to say. C'est-à-dire. That's what's been missed out. So, in other words, passage 341, the Hinge passage, is an explanation of passage 340. That is to say. And what does 340 say? Well, 340 says this. We know with the same certainty with which we believe any mathematical proposition, how the letters A and B are pronounced, what the color of human blood is called, that other human beings have blood, and call it blood. Notice the Hinge passage is a passage on a certain kind of knowledge. Here's the second feature of the way the Hinge passage is normally misread. That is to say, it belongs to the logic of our scientific investigations that certain propositions are indeed not doubt. Hinges, in other words, enable scientific, wissenschaftliche investigations, not just natural science, systematic inquiry. But notice, they are not, at least, or not by Wittgenstein, invoked to explain knowledge in general. They are invoked as an account of the conditions of possibility for wissenschaftliche Untersuchungen. Proponents of Hinge epistemology ignore, typically, or deny, as Duncan Pritchard recently did at a conference, this evident feature of Wittgenstein's position. They're committed antecedently to the view that Hinge propositions are not what Wittgenstein says they are. Well, I think we should take Wittgenstein at his word. What happens if we do? Then we will draw the following conclusion. In the Hinge passages, Wittgenstein is claiming only that systematic investigations depend on a background of everyday knowledge. It follows from this, though, that since Wittgenstein's conception of hinges presupposes an answer to both Cartesian and Agrippan skepticism, it cannot be intended as his response to skepticism in either of its forms. That's my first point. It's a purely textual point. But what's called hinged epistemology has precisely nothing to do with Wittgenstein. It depends on an edited quotation of passage 341 and ignoring a crucial qualification in passage 342. Well, there's an objection to what I just said, and anyone who's familiar with this debate already knows what it is, namely that Wittgenstein tells us flat out that it is nonsense to see hinge propositions or basic certainties as knowledge. And here's a much quoted passage, passage 10. I know that a sick man is lying here. Nonsense. So I don't know then. Neither the question nor the assertion makes sense, any more than the assertion, I am here, which I might yet use at any moment if a suitable occasion presented itself. There are other passages like this. Proponents of hinge epistemology take these passages to be, and similar passages to be decisive for their view. But they ignore 340. So at the very least, we'd have to say there's a deep tension in Wittgenstein's views, that sometimes he treats hinge-like propositions as known, and sometimes he says it's nonsense to think of them in that way. That would be the minimum. We would have to say that Wittgenstein doesn't have a consistent view. In fact, I think there's no contradiction in Wittgenstein's view at all, and these passages don't show what people think they show. Now, I'm not claiming that Wittgenstein got here before Grice, but I am claiming that he shows a practical sensitivity to what we might call a Gricean distinction. And in the passage 10 that I just quoted, Wittgenstein is not commenting on knowing, but on claiming to know. That's to say, the entering of an explicit knowledge claim. Now, in normal circumstances, my saying I know with respect to some banal and obvious fact is nonsense in the sense that I fail to perform a significant speech act. I have no intelligible, communicative, or justificatory intention in uttering those words. It does not follow from this that bedrock certainties are not known. As a matter of fact, it doesn't follow from this that Wittgenstein has any view about, quote, the essence of knowledge as such. He might, but you certainly can't take it, any such lesson from passages like this. But now I think there are two things we need to look at here. So let's look at, first of all, at ordinary knowledge claims. Now, a common speech act, I wouldn't say it's the essential speech act, a common speech act function of saying I know is to offer assurance in response to a question, say, how do you know, or do you know, or why do you believe? Here there's a very good book, I think, on Austin by Crystal Lawler, which I commend to you, called Assurance. Lawler argues that according to Austin, a common speech act function is indeed to offer assurance. But I think it's perfectly obvious that assurance is not in prospect with respect to bedrock certainties that are already shared. Here's 84. I believe, for example, that I know as much about this matter, the existence of the earth, as Moore does, and that if he knows that it's as he says, then I know it too. So notice, Moore is in no position to assure Wittgenstein about the existence of the earth, because Wittgenstein already doesn't doubt it. But does Wittgenstein therefore think that common knowledge is an oxymoron, contradictio in adjecto? Surely not. A second thing we have to recognize, though, is that when Wittgenstein is talking about the ineffectiveness, or however we wish to think of it, perhaps even nonsensical character of saying I know in uncertainty, he's often concerned not with ordinary common knowledge, but with extraordinary Mourian knowledge claims. That's to say, saying I know in a philosophical context in which the legitimacy of skeptical doubts has already been conceded, and offering, so to say, Mourian assurance as a response to them. And I think it's evident to anyone that such claims misfire. I can't assuage a skeptic's doubts by assuring him that I know that the things he calls in question. Nevertheless, I may indeed know what the skeptic purports to doubt. Well, here's a more theoretical argument from Daniel Moyle-Sharrock. Here's the quote. Wittgenstein does not take bedrock certainty to be a knowing because he adheres to the standard view of knowledge as justified true belief. That's from her recent paper, The Animal, or Putting the Animal into Knowledge. I think this is, I don't know where she gets this from, actually. I mean, Wittgenstein nowhere offers an analysis of knowledge as, say, a statement of necessary and sufficient conditions for the truth of propositions like S knows the P, anywhere in his corpus. What he does do, and here he's like Austin, is he creeps up on the concept of knowledge by way of considering the performative expressive or speech act functions of saying I know. Although, as I've just argued, you can't, as it were, make a simple one-step inferential move from features of speech act function to questions of how the concept of knowledge is to be understood. A second thing, Daniel's conclusion depends on tying justification to evidence, including self-evidence, i.e. in some way or another, positive grounds. And perhaps Wittgenstein inclines this way. But you might recall a famous passage from the Philosophical Investigations. To use a word without justification, Rechtfertigung, does not mean to use it wrongfully. Unrecht, Anscombe, without right. I mean, I think one of the problems with the claim knowledge is justified true belief is it's completely unclear what it means. Alston pointed out years ago that justification in Anglophone epistemology is not a word of ordinary language, as Austin himself pointed out in Other Minds. But as Alston says, it's a semi-technical term in epistemology, and a good deal of what epistemologists argue about is what on earth it should mean. I mean, as it were, you know, should justification imply evidence? Would a purely externalistic account of it make sense? And so on. So, very unclear, even if one conceded that Wittgenstein thought that knowledge was justified to belief, you'd need to know what he thought justification was, which simply can't be read off from anyone's intuitions. Let's back up. Here's some very, very early passages. In fact, the very beginning of the very first thing Wittgenstein says in Uncertainty, thinking of Moore's proof of an external world, if you do know that here is one hand, we'll grant you all the rest. He actually doesn't grant him all the rest, but we won't go into that. But here's the passage I like to look at. When one says that such and such proposition can't be proved, of course, that does not mean that it can't be derived from other propositions. Any proposition can be derived from other propositions, but they may be no more certain than it is itself. And you can easily see there's going to be an issue here with banal certainties of everyday life. It'd be very difficult for them to find grounds, even including things like, you know, the reliability of the senses, because nothing you could cite would be more certain than they antecedently are. So tying everyday knowledge to grounds is already intrinsically problematic, if you think this remark here is correct. 243, Wittgenstein says, one says I know when one is ready to give compelling grounds. I know relates to a possibility of demonstrating the truth. But if what he believes is of such a kind that the grounds he can give are no surer than his assertion, then he cannot say he knows what he believes. But notice, I want to link that back. It would be an idle speech act. Doesn't mean he doesn't know what he believes. Still, prima facie, these passages may seem to support Daniel's claim. But as I said, again, they concern the Speech Act. And anyway, Wittgenstein does not say that one says, I know, only when one is in a position to give compelling grounds. Check out 272. I know. And by the way, notice here, this is I know, not saying I know. I know equals, is equivalent to, I am familiar with it as a certainty. Okay, so what is certainty? How does it relate to knowledge and grounds? Well, let's take knowledge first off. From it seeming to me or to everyone to be so, it doesn't follow that it is so. What we can ask is whether it can make sense to doubt it. If someone says, I know, I don't know if there's a hand here, he might be told, look closer. This possibility of satisfying oneself is part of the language game, is one of its essential features. What about such a proposition as, I know that I have a brain. Can I doubt it? Grounds for doubt are lacking. Nevertheless, it is imaginable that my skull should turn out empty when it was operated on. And Wittgenstein is quite careful here. Imaginable has to do with imaginations, Vorstellung. Later on, when he turns to the question of possibility, of course, he uses a very different word, möglich. I think what's already being suggested here is that objective certainty is not tied exclusively to either conclusive reasons or self-evidence. It may, in fact, be grounded in the absence of intelligible doubts. There may be propositions that we cannot doubt because attempts to doubt them are incoherent. They do not make sense. Doubts, intelligible or reasonable, and I think there's no bright line between a doubt becoming increasingly unreasonable and it's becoming utterly unintelligible, always need grounds. That's to say, some way in which I might be going wrong. Why? In terms of our everyday practice, because unless I know what you think my problem is, I have no idea what I need to do to assuage your doubts. I mean, very often the correct response to someone saying, why do you believe that, is to ask, how do you think I could be going wrong? If there's no answer to that question, what on earth are you supposed to say? So if these points alone are granted, there's at least no barrier to seeing the everyday beliefs that are the hinges of systematic inquiry as objective certainties. Maybe they're things we just can't understand, with respect to which we cannot understand expressions of doubt, or in general, how do you know questions. This isn't to say that how do you know questions can't be answered in a way, but the way would violate the greater certainty condition of one. I mean, if you appeal to the reliability of the senses, is that more certain than some general... Actually, if Susanna's right, it's probably not merely less certain, but not even true. Any general thing I could say as a layman about the reliability of the senses is less certain than here is a lectern. So, I mean, to appeal to the reliability of the senses, to argue how do you, you know, why do you think there's a lectern here? I certainly couldn't give you anything that had, so to say, an antecedently higher epistemic value than the proposition, my knowledge of which you have questioned. Okay, so a second thing to remember, though, is that grounds for doubt, and this is going back to Ford and the question of Wittgenstein's brain, are not as easy to come by as skeptics think. And in particular, fairy tale imaginings like brains in vats don't count. Well, you can imagine what's going to be said here. Well, sure, we don't ordinarily consider such things, but surely they are possibilities, and possibilities that are indeed impossible to rule out. Again, I think, though, there is very little antecedent plausibility to this response. Here's an example. Is it possible that when I go back to my hotel tonight, I will see an email marked urgent? It's from Jurgen Klopp, the manager of my favorite football team, Liverpool football team, saying, Michael, get on a plane. We need you to start at centre forward for our game against Newcastle on Saturday. Now, I think the answer to that question is no. Just no. By the way, I'm channeling Stephen Toulmin here. His original example had to do with Dwight Eisenhower captaining the American Davis Cup team at tennis. The answer to the question, is it possible, is no. Here's what the answer isn't. It depends what you mean by possible. Well, do you mean epistemically possible? Do you mean scientifically possible? Do you mean metaphysically possible? That's not the answer. The answer is no. Can we imagine this happening to me? Sure. Hollywood movies do it all the time. It's possible in exactly the sense that it's possible that Sleeping Beauty goes to sleep for 100 years and is wakened by a kiss. How does it happen? Don't ask. It's possible in the way that Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff and doesn't fall until he looks down, at which point he plummets to disaster. Imaginability in the sense of involving no immediate or obvious contradiction is not a test for possibility in any sense. Is it possible that I'm a brain in a vat? No, it isn't. Can we tell stories? Yes. I've been to the Matrix like anyone else. What do? You ignore the contradictions. You probably noticed the major contradiction in the Matrix, by the way. Keanu Reeves starts off as the victim of the evil deceiver and ends and turns into G.E. Moore, having imagined himself to drink a red liquid. All of a sudden, he gets tumbled into the cold water, and then all of a sudden, here is one lake, and I'm in it. Well, we know what's going to be said here, and Wittgenstein anticipates the response at passage 18 to 19. I know often means I have the proper grounds for my statement, so if the other person is acquainted with the language game, he would admit that I know. The statement, I know here is a hand, may then be continued, for it's my hand I'm looking at. Then a reasonable man will not doubt that I know, nor will the idealist. Rather, he will say that he's not dealing with the practical doubt, which is being dismissed, but there is a further doubt behind that one. That this is an illusion has to be shown in a different way. Now, notice Wittgenstein thinks this is an enormously significant concession to get from the skeptic. Okay, I'm not talking about how epistemic questions are entered and resolved in ordinary contexts. I'm talking about a special doubt that belongs to the context of philosophical reflection on, e.g., knowledge of the external world or knowledge in general. But now Wittgenstein makes, I think, a very important move. 24. Wittgenstein here refers to the idealist because, as he realizes, Moore's proof of an external world paper isn't actually about skepticism the way it's thought to be today. It's part of Moore's episode in Moore's lifelong battle against idealism. The idealist, or let's here say the skeptic's question, would be something like, what right have I not to doubt the existence of my hands? And to that, the answer can't be, I know that they exist. Notice Wittgenstein's already, in a way, prepared the ground for refusing this question, because it assumes, so to say, that there's something like a standing right to ask, how do you know? Which, of course, if doubts need grounds, is not a feature of ordinary doubt. Doubting. But someone who asks such a question, this is the passage I want to stress, is overlooking the fact that a doubt about existence only works in a language game. Hence, we should first have to ask, what would such a doubt be like? And don't understand this straight off. Wittgenstein's point here is that philosophical doubt, as the skeptic has admitted, is not an extension or intensification of ordinary doubting, but rather a language game of its own. It's, as passage 19 puts it, the doubt behind the doubt. All right, how is the game played? What are the rules? Well, according to Wittgenstein, the rules turn on overlooking something, which is not just about ordinary, not straightforwardly merely a point about ordinary knowledge, it's a point about knowledge and certainty, at least as human beings in general have them anywhere. Namely, that knowledge claims are always as entered in particular circumstances. Or 25, one may be wrong even about there being a hand here. Only in certain particular circumstances is it impossible. But note, impossible. Even in a calculation, one can be wrong. Only in certain circumstances, one can't. The possibility of doubt is circumstantially dependent, or as Charles Travis puts it, occasion sensitive. If this is right, skeptical arguments are standardly presented, the famous argument for ignorance, i.g., I know here's a hand, I don't know, here is one, I'm not a brain in a vat, if I don't know, I'm not a brain in a vat, I don't know, here is a hand, paradox. That's how the skepticism is often put today. They've gone wrong from day one by assuming that knowledge concerns decontextualized propositions or propositional contents, as opposed to claims made by or commitments undertaken by particular speakers in particular circumstances, what Austin calls statements. Now, can it be seen from a rule, though, what circumstances logically exclude mistake in the employment of rules of calculation? No, but what use is to a rule to us here? Mightn't we in turn go wrong in applying it? Yes, we might, but mostly we don't. Mostly we don't go wrong in calculation anyway. No rule about how to identify correct calculating, circumstances in which calculating can't go wrong, would be no more certain and probably much less certain than the actual certainty of an actual calculation performed in propitious circumstances. So again, it would violate the condition on reasons which are laid down in uncertainty one. It would have no justificatory potential, the rule. The circumstances in which mistakes are impossible, though, can be recognized, but not by virtue of applying a rule. They depend on a kind of know-how, a recognition of ability. And applying the rule would be the same. Wittgenstein, however, is inclined to draw, I think, a very strong conclusion from this, namely that knowledge is not an object of systematic theory. But what makes no difference in practice shouldn't matter in theory either. So I'm looking at you, Jean-Baptiste, right? I mean, if we don't need it, so to say, for any everyday purpose, it's by no means clear why we need it as philosophers trying to understand what knowledge is. So what sort of proposition is this? We cannot have miscalculated in 12 by 12 equals log 44. It must surely be a proposition of logic, but now, is it not the same, or doesn't it come to the same as the statement 12 times 12 equals 144? Passage 44, if you demand a rule from which it follows that there can't have been a miscalculation here, the answer is that we did not learn this through a rule, but through learning to calculate. There was a remark by Gilbert Harman that I really like in a symposium on Larry Bonjour's book, when he stopped being a coherence theorist and became a born-again foundationalist. He wrote a book called In Defense of Pure Reason, and he gave some intuitive examples of propositions known by rational insight, one of which was 5 plus 3 equals 8. Harman rather dryly remarks, "Isn't this something I learned in school? What does rational insight have to do with it?" And that's a very Wittgensteinian remark. 55, so is the hypothesis possible?
now here possible, not imaginable, that all the things around us don't exist? Would that not be like the hypothesis of our having miscalculated in all our calculations? And here I think Wittgenstein shows that he doesn't really believe in epistemology as, so to say, self-standing subject. Here's from 80. The truth of my statements is the test of my understanding of those statements. That's to say, if I make certain false statements, it becomes uncertain whether I understand them. And I think we can say the same about expressions of doubt. If I say to you 5 plus 3 equals 8, or maybe I'm muttering 5 plus 3 equals 8 while I'm balancing my checkbook, and you say to me 5 plus 3 equals 8, I see what you mean, but I'm not so sure. How on earth can I take that? If you don't see what I mean, you haven't learned to add up. There's an interesting connection here with traditional foundationalism. Traditional empiricist foundationalism tries to actually bait the idea of foundational judgments on there being a truth to meaning connection, in the sense that there are certain propositions such that if correctly articulated in terms of the semantic rules, then you can't go wrong. Things like this here red were the paradigm example. You focus on something and then you apply some primitive recognitional concept to it. And the thought is, you can't go wrong if you make, so to say, the judgment in full understanding of its meaning. Wittgenstein, in a way, agrees with this, but detaches it from any specific propositional content. It's merely reattaching it, taking it from, as it were, abstract contents to circumstances. In particular circumstances, there is a meaning or understanding to truth connection, in that if you don't get things right, it becomes completely unclear what, if anything, you understand by the judgment you make. The difference is, however, this is not systematically theorizable. So largely correct use is a condition of understanding. And in this respect, there's no essential difference between elementary mathematical and simple empirical judgments. In Wittgenstein's view, once the occasion sensitivity of judgments is taken into consideration, the circumstantial dependence, not just anything can be intelligibly doubted. The problem then is that skeptical problems simply take belief and meaning for granted. The skeptic says, I've got all these beliefs, but how could I justify them? Why do I have the right to take any of them to amount to knowledge? I think that hinge epistemology shares this presupposition by assuming that skepticism as an epistemological problem needs a purely epistemological solution. Wittgenstein, by contrast, thinks that this kind of intervention comes too late. And I think the intractability of hinge epistemology's core problem supports his view. So, to sum up then, and this is a small fragment of a little book I hope I'm writing on certainty, Wittgenstein approaches skepticism via his views about meaning and mind. For Wittgenstein, as for Austin, the bearers of truth, thus candidates for being known, are not decontextualized propositional contents, but claims or commitments made or undertaken by particular people in particular circumstances. Propitious circumstances can be recognized, but they cannot be reduced to rule. Wittgenstein is, in consequence, a skeptic about the very idea of epistemology as a systematic theory of knowledge. More than that, he thinks that skepticism is the evil twin of the aspiration to understand knowledge, so to say, in full generality, independently of circumstantial considerations. In other words, the tendency to ask questions like, how do I know anything at all about the external world? Where now, knowledge of the external world is identified simply by a special class of propositional contents, which are deemed to be external world propositions. So, I hate to say this, at a conference on principles of epistemology, in a sense, there aren't any. We use judgments as principles of judgment, says Wittgenstein. And I think about that, he's just right. Thank you.